Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the Road to Creativity, part of the Podmatch Podcast Network. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And one of the great things that I truly love about getting to meet with all these amazing creatives is knowing that throughout all the different twists and turns and stops and restarts, they never gave up. They kept on pushing forward. And in a lot of cases, they're reaping the benefits of seeing that come to life. And this week's guest is definitely no exception. Margaret Philbrick started out as a writer of children's books way back in 2009, and 15 years later in 2024, she released her novel House of Honor, which became a 7-time award winner and also got a Kirkus starred review. This is a tremendous journey that Margaret has been on, and I'm very flattered that she reached out to discuss this on our show. So I am really happy to have her here, and she is a perfect example of what Excelsior Journeys is all about. So it is my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Margaret Philbrick. Margaret, how are you?
I'm doing really well. George, thank you so much for letting me be on your show. I love this topic. I think that it's so easy to not finish work in the writing world and also just be so overwhelmed sometimes with ideas that you don't even know where to begin. And so I hope that this conversation inspires people to, you know, stay the course on a particular tact that they are excited and passionate about, and they can see it through to the finish. This book took me, my most recent book, House of Honor, took 9 years. And so it is by far the longest I've ever worked on a project. And so it definitely takes, as they say, some glue your butt to the chair to really get through it and gut it out and get your vision accomplished and not settle. There's a lot of ways in writing that people sort of settle just to get it done. And I just really was sticking to it and not doing that. So, yeah, I look forward to the conversation. And I want to provide for your listeners the most insight I can. So, you just tell me what you want to know and I'll do my best.
Well, basically, just learning about your journey was already inspiring. Just knowing that you were someone who started in one field and wanted to break out into other ones and never gave up, never stopped believing that they would go forward with what they wanted to do. And in this day and age, the way that independent publishing is and small presses and all the different opportunities that are given in publishing, it's so much more freeing to be able to focus on one thing, on one genre, and then move over to another one. With a lot of the traditional publishers, they insist on continuing on as a children's book author because that's where you started. So that's where you want to be known as. And what you've been able to do since then is not only very inspiring, but also very motivating. I definitely need to refasten my own butt to my chair with everything that I'm working on as well. So I think that this will be a tremendous discussion. And once again, big shout out to Podmatch for bringing us together. This site has been very show changing, I would say, for myself over the past 5 years with all the different people that I've had on here and now being a part of the podcast Podmatch Network. And now being part of the Podmatch Podcast Network, I am just really excited for what the future brings. So thank you very much for reaching out. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
Good. That's great. Yeah, I'd love to chat a little bit about how I crossed over genre and why I did that. And I do think that it's important for people in their creative work to not feel like they are being put in a box, or so they say in Hollywood, right, typecast into a certain role as a creative, because there's just, you don't need to ever think that. There's always some, everyone says, oh, there's nothing new under the sun, but there's always a new slant on an old idea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that when you are, as a writer, pursuing an idea, there's a certain, you know, we describe it as creative flow that allows you to know, am I minding in the right vein here? Am I really pursuing something that is true to the message that and purpose that I'm trying to achieve with this? And when that is happening, there is a flow. There, for me, there's been like an ease, even though it takes a long time, there is an ease in the process. And that's when I know, okay, this is where I need to be right now. Rather than, oh gosh, I've started with a children's book, and so I'm just going to keep doing that. Because we all want to be challenged in our creative work. And because I did the children's book, and I really enjoyed that. I did it with my mother, and that made it incredible, because my mother died in COVID, but she was a wonderful artist. And so it was her idea. She wanted to do all the paintings for the book, to create it together and do the book tour together. And that was a blast. And then that made me hungry to do something more meaty and more substantial. Right. So I was like, let's do a novel. Why don't I write a novel? Because that sounds really interesting and really difficult. So I think that it's good to always be putting things that are out of reach and not comfortable in your creative toolbox. You know, what can I be reaching for that sounds like I'm going to grow and isn't just the comfort zone that I, you know I can do? And every single genre is going to be challenging. I mean, it's always hard unless you just sit there and talk to AI and then have them spit something out to you that is awful. And then you just decide, well, I'm going to do is revise this and refine it. I mean, I think that, you know, that's a whole separate conversation. I don't do that. My Instagram, it's called Seasoned Poetess, and it's my photography with a corresponding poem. And I love that because it's so quick and fresh. I don't overthink these poems. I take a photo, you know, something that really catches my eye. I'm in Savannah today, and the sun coming through all of the hanging Spanish moss in the live oak trees with the sun behind it. It was so gorgeous. And so I snapped some pictures of that. And then I'll go away for a while and just think about that picture. And then I'll just whip out a poem and put it on my Seasoned Poetess Instagram. And that's just a lovely moment of lightness and levity. And it brings fresh creativity to a bigger work that I'm actually working on. And so I just love having these little glimmers and flickers of creativity in the midst of the bigger project. And that has been good. And it says in the intro line, the byline is, no filters, nothing fake, no AI. And that is kind of
a good way to do it.
I don't want anything fake. Right. It's like, this is real work from a real person. And if it takes time, you know, to crank it out, that's okay. I think that I've never been someone who can write on a contract that's a multi-book contract, because then you're in the mill. You're in the middle of, this is my deadline. I have to get this done. I have to have it done by X time. And I've always had a different publisher for every book. And which means I've had a different timeline for every book.
Yeah.
And I prefer that. That's definitely not for everybody. I mean, you know,
no, of course not.
Some people wouldn't like that, but it works for me because it gives me the freedom that I really need. Yeah.
Yeah. And definitely when it comes to just kind of going back to like what you were saying at the beginning of that, you know, like when you said that you always want to keep challenging yourself, it's very much that the phrase a man's reach should extend his grasp, or what's a heaven for, that really comes to mind.
Correct.
And when it comes to, constantly trying to not so much top yourself, but at least try to move forward, try to improve yourself all the time, try to be a better person today than you were yesterday. That seems like, so that way the only person that you're really in competition with is yourself. So there's a lot to unpack here with everything that you do, everything that you are focusing on, all the different platforms, all the different venues in terms of all the different ways that you express yourself is definitely ripe for a conversation. But let's start at the latest thing here, House of Honor. This was like the culmination of the first 15 years of your journey as a writer. So what is House of Honor about? Tell us what got you into writing that in the first place.
Sure. I was in Italy on a graduation trip for one of our kids, and I went into a chapel there in a church. It's called Santa Maria dei Francesi. It's the French chapel that happens to be in Rome, the French church. And in the corner on the upper front left of it, there's all these chapels and then the main church. And up in the front left is a chapel with three Caravaggio. Even though my mother was a painter, she was crazy about the Impressionists. And so that was the era that I knew well. And I didn't really know the Renaissance painters very well. And I saw those three Caravaggios and I was kind of surrounded by them. They're giant paintings. And there's one over the altar and two on the sides. And I really had an experience in art where, and the simplest thing can do this to someone. It could be just a line of a poem or something. But I felt like I was just being drawn in to this person as the artist in a way that made me desperately want to know more about them. He depicted people as very gritty and not idealized. They had dirty feet. They had dirty nails. They had stringy hair. You know, it was nothing like, you know, cherubs and puffy clouds, which was really the typical thing in the Renaissance. And I thought, you know, who is this? I mean, on the right is Peter being crucified upside down. You know, on the front is Matthew getting the gospel, and he's just leaning on it to a writing desk with his giant feet, just dirty and gross. And I'm like, this is something. And so I wanted only just to know about this artist and his work. And so that got me into researching him, which was fantastic, totally fantastic. And, you know, then I was like, oh, this is so incredible. I have to now learn all about his paintings. And so I did that too. And that led me into finding out that the Nativity painting, he painted two Nativities, and the Nativity painting that was in Palermo was actually cut out of the frame with a box cutter in 1969. Wow. It was October 17th, an October night. It's never been recovered. And I thought, well, what happened to it? Why did that happen? Who did it? And it just ushered in just an enormous amount of questions. And so I just didn't really think I was going to write this book. But once I had the answers to the questions and it sewed in the mafia and the Vatican, the corruption of the finance of the Vatican, I thought was really fascinating at the time the painting was taken, and the relationships and how they all intertwined, I thought, boy, this would be a fun book to write. And that Caravaggio moment is what launched me into doing it.
Nice. It has an interesting combination of almost like a little bit of Da Vinci Code and a little bit of Godfather Part Three, where there's that sort of corruption within the Vatican. So like that sounds really fascinating. I'm definitely looking forward to checking this out.
Well, it's cool that you picked that up, because one of the reviewers, and they ended up picking this, the publisher did, to put on the front of the book. It says the Godfather meets the Da Vinci Code, but with a redemptive twist. So there you go. I mean, so you're right on it.
There you go.
So yeah, I think that's an apt description. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I did a lot of research. I mean, I did 3 years of research for the book. I traveled to a lot of really cool places to do the research. So that made it pretty juicy and enticing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it had to be a character driven story. And I decided to have Caravaggio's life be the model life for the main character, Orazio Bordoni, because Caravaggio's life was insane, completely insane. He didn't live long, and he did all kinds of brilliant things and disastrous things in his very short life. And so once I really had a beat on him and on his art, I thought, boy, this would be fun to create a modern day character who is modeled after Caravaggio and then use the art as the jumping off point for the plot. So that's kind of how it rolls.
It sounds a lot like the research was a lot of fun to do as you were doing it. Just sounded like you had an idea, you started the research and everything, and then all of a sudden you're finding one thing and then something else and then something else. And it just became, sounds like a real good snowball effect with all of these different elements you were grabbing. And then all of a sudden you were ready to just get it out there on the page and see where it takes
you. Yes. Oh my gosh, yes, that's exactly what it was. Because when I read about the banker that the Vatican had at this time, his name was Michele Sindona, and I read all about him. I read quite a few books on the Vatican and the Vatican Bank. And I thought, oh my gosh, I mean, this character is so ripe for the... And I call him in the book, the banker. He's the only character that doesn't have a name. And he's the one who really is underground. I mean, he's very much a clandestine underground character who has OCD and has a lot of, you know, mental health issues, but he's brilliant. And he is one of the main, he's one of the main intrigue characters of the story. And I've had people who've read the book write to me and say, gosh, I hope you're going to write a prequel called The Banker. Because I want to know why the banker ended up like, how did he get like this? How did this happen to him?
Right.
And so, you know, I don't think I'm going to do that. But he is a very fun character modeled after someone who was a real person, for sure. Yeah.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that that character was someone that Francis Ford Coppola really latched onto. And that was part of the inspiration that went into The Godfather Part 3. So that was a lot of people really kind of focus on the parts in that film that did not work nearly as well as what worked in parts one and two. But those elements, everything about the Vatican, everything about the dealings with Michael and trying to basically cheat him out of everything that he had built. I think that all that stuff was truly fascinating. So knowing that is what inspired this book, I am so in. I am really excited to get this take on it. So I'm really excited for it.
Yeah. And I appreciate, George, that you said, you know, the work needs to make me a better person, and it needs to also impact the reader to give them something that would, you know, that's why fiction is so beautiful. It really does make you think about the world and take you places in the world and really help you view what is my part in it. And am I contributing? How am I living in the great story? And I feel like this book, you know, hopefully does that for people in the way that there's so many characters. I love to ask people when I do book clubs, so who is your favorite character? And, you know, it's always someone different. Everyone always has a different person. And I think that, you know, they're connecting, right, and making those connections because hopefully they have an empathy or some kind of personal affinity to that character. And then you thereby think, you know, how, why, you know, what is this character doing for me? What is it that is it about them that really makes me want to be living, you know, into that part of the story? So, yeah, I think that that's a big goal. I'm not a big one on like tragic endings. I definitely like tragedy for sure. I studied Shakespeare. I never really loved the comedies. I like the tragedies. And I do think that there's a real thing there that Shakespeare's doing with, you know, sometimes people are going to have to die and we don't want them to die, of course. But that's just part of the living story. And so, yeah, I think that giving people hope through the work, but also addressing the reality of the fragility and brokenness of the world is just a huge job, especially in our day, of the writer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And with everything that you've done at that point, let's go back to the beginning of it all. Like back when you had first gotten into the idea of writing in the first place. One of the things that I love to hear about is what I call the road to creativity. And that's when you experience something or read something, meet someone, and it just makes you say, oh, I would love to do that. And then you get off of the road that you're on. And then all of a sudden you're merging onto this whole other highway going in a whole different direction. And it's a direction with purpose. It's one where you feel like this is what I need to be doing. What was it about writing in general that made you grasp onto it like this?
I remember one time, quite a long time ago, someone said to me, you know, you're a professional communicator. And I thought, what does that even mean? And at the time I was working in advertising, I worked for Leo Burnett and sold Kellogg's products, lots of different ones, through advertising. And I love that. And I think that's what they were referring to. But over the course of my life, I started there when I was 22 years old. And I worked there up until when I turned 30. And I remember thinking, there's a lot of really good psychological strategy behind how we make these ads. It's a real thing, the psychology behind advertising. I thought it'd be so fascinating to now shift that into the psychology of character development within story, within literature. And I was a literature major. And then I went to England and studied Shakespeare and the postmodern poets over there in England after college. And so I really was drawn into the idea of, you know, shaping the psychology and the mindset of character within a bigger story than a 30-minute ad or a 60-minute ad or whatever it was, you know, we were working on. And so I always had that intrigue and interest. And I thought, wow, that would be so exciting to, you know, take a and build a world through a piece of literature that I was actually working on. And I didn't know when it was going to happen. I knew eventually I would do it, but my mother was the one who said to me, I think we should write that story. And I was so jarred by it. I was like, why did you say that? You know what? You're not the writer. I said, Mother, you'd have to do the art. I mean, I have no access to artists. I mean, I'm coming from advertising. And she was like, well, she said, maybe I will. I think maybe that sounds fun. And so it took her a year to do all the paintings for that book. And because she was committed, that got me rolling. And that really is what launched me into telling, you know, and creating story as a means by which you can position truth in the world and tragedy and redemption and all the themes that, you know, drive life and make life meaningful. You know, it's funny. I went to a wedding not that long ago and it was beautiful. I mean, of course, the couple's in love, it's beautiful. But I walked away from it and I was like, it was all so beautiful, but there really wasn't much meaning. I didn't really take away something that I thought about. I didn't take away something to chew on. And I was like, there's just not enough meaning here. And so making meaning, I think, is another piece of what really has drawn me into wanting to create literature. Yeah.
Nice. Just kind of giving your take on it, kind of injecting your own perspective into something.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I'm working on, that's interesting. I'm working on right now my first nonfiction book. And
really?
I realized that I have been a gardener, as in growing gardens, since I was a child. And so I really do have a pretty expansive garden life. And now that we've raised three kids and they're all living off in their own gardens, basically, I was like, it'd be so cool to create a book about what it means to grow a home like a garden. And all the stages, how does it translate into soil, into plants, you know, into seeding, into feeding, into harvesting, into all these different parts. And I decided, well, that's fascinating to me, but I really want to have people who are experts in those areas speak into the book. And I don't want it to be all about me because that would be, you know, boring. It's not like my memoir or something. And so I interviewed all kinds of different people for these sections. And wow, I was so enlightened by the things that they have said to me.
Really?
And I just thought, boy, this is the gestalt of why this creative endeavor is so fascinating. Because, you know, you learn from the people that you're doing it with. And then you give away, you know, what it is that you've learned in your own life as well as from them, and you hand it off, and it takes on a life of its own in the readers, in the life of the readers. Yeah, and it was just been really cool. I'm about halfway done, you know, with that book, and boy, I'm just loving it, you know. And it's so, yeah, I think that that's, and I think that's part of it too, is growing things and, you know, tangibly like working soil and making things flourish. I feel like that, even, you know, in any creative pursuit, that's an analogy that applies, because it takes a lot of work. You're digging right in the dirt, so to speak, quite a while before you get to any kind of flourishing. Right.
And you're also, it also feels very validating when you're speaking with those, with those other types of, you basically say, authority figures on what it is that you're working on.
Yes.
It just feels like you're on your way.
And I just, you know, I couldn't believe, it's so fascinating. I mean, I had, there's a section in the book, it's the pruning section. And, you know, when we were growing tomatoes, the first few years of doing it, they just got giant and they got leggy and they just were all over the place. I mean, they just grew like crazy in Chicago. And then I realized I got to cut these way back. If I want good, big fruit, I got to cut these plants down, because they're putting all their energy into growing the plants and the fruit is really small. And so pruning then, you know, just became something I learned over trial and error. So I talked to this woman, and in her life at 45, her husband that she'd been married to for 5 years, he died of cancer, and she had a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. And she talks, and I interviewed her about what does that look like? Like, that's a pruning in life, you know, that is devastating. And how do you recover from that? And how do you get fruit and flowering out of that? Mm-hmm. Well, she had a lot of great answers. So yeah.
That's terrific. And it almost sounds like what I've been doing with this podcast for so long, because I am speaking with authority figures on what it is that they do and what it is that they've worked on, what it is that the different journeys that they have traveled that have led them over to this. Yet I have enough experience that I can definitely keep up with what is being said and what is being discussed and what is being presented as on the show. So it sounds like you have yourself just like a really good compact version of what this show has become over the years.
That's neat. Yeah. But with a lot of humor. I don't know if you have a lot of humor, hopefully, but
I try. I definitely try.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Whether or not people find me funny, that's up to them. I just put it out there.
Well, I do. I think you're funny. So I'm going to say, you got it.
Thank you.
But yeah, I mean, you know, you got to have it. And I mean, gosh, you know, there's so many stories of like one of my funny stories of, you know, growing things is I had people come for a Christmas brunch, we'll call it like a Christmas brunch. And all of the glasses were in the basement. And I forgot that. And I had all the flower arrangements and I had all the food done and I had all the fun things. And I was like, oh gosh, the glasses. And so I went down. I had spent so much time on the flowers and making it beautiful, I kind of forgot about the glasses. And so I go down to the basement and I just unpack them and I just pull them out and I just like dump them out and, you know, pour the drinks. And one lady says to me, wow, there's like a fly in my glass and it's December. Oh. I mean, where in the world did this fly come from?
Oh no.
Kind of like April? didn't wash the glasses. That's sorry. You know, it's kind of focused on all the plants. So I mean, it's just so many funny things that happen, you know, and you have to be able to just laugh about it and not freak out about it. Right.
Right. Right, absolutely. And so in 2009 you were starting with more younger fare. How long were you in that field before you decided you wanted to go into something more mature?
Yeah, I did that book and then I got my master's degree in teaching because I wanted to teach writing and literature. And as part of that program, I wrote another children's book, which actually is about gardens. It's pretty funny. I never submitted it for publication, but I love it because I did the art myself. And I just got that idea. Like, I want to create art. And it's adorable. It's called Wanda's Wandering Wisteria. And it's about this vine that takes over this girl's entire home. And like, just, it gets out of control. And nice. So, you know, I did that. And I mean, maybe someday I'll do something with that, you know, but it's still like sitting on its little shelf as a complete, you know, my project kind of thing. And so then I went into teaching writing and literature. And as I was doing that, I got the bee in my bonnet that I really did want to challenge myself to write a novel. And it happened to work out because our oldest son was going off to college, and he was a wonderful pianist, studied piano his whole life. And when I would go to his piano lessons, the teacher made me take notes on what he was doing and learning, and then go over the notebook and what was happening in the lesson during the week so he could remember all the little things that she was trying to get him to do. So I was sort of the teacher at home, and then he had this fabulous teacher in the lessons. Well, when he went to college, I had these great notebooks, and I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, I have all this wisdom about the piano in these books, and I love music. I play the flute and I play the piano and stuff. And I was like, oh, wow. I should just do this. So I ended up coming up with the vein of, it was just the time where it was coming out that music provides memory recall for Alzheimer's and dementia patients when you curate the music.
What was it called? This is Your Brain on Music, right?
Yes, I read that book. That's right. Good job. I read it as part of the research for that novel. And, you know, and there was Oliver Sacks, who was coming out with Musicophilia. It was like a thing. It was a very trendy thing at that time. And it was just like a new discovery. I mean, they were doing all kinds of research that was coming out about it. And so I decided to create the story of this piano prodigy who's 18, and he falls in love with his piano teacher, and she's in her 50s. And she ends up getting early onset dementia. And it's about how they bridge her decline and his ascension through music, and how the language of music allows for them to continue to be in relationship, and how that evolves as he is going to the Tchaikovsky piano competition and she wants to accompany him there and all the things that happen as a result of her having this dementia. And so those notebooks are that's the thing that inspired me to really want to write that story, because I knew that I had the authentic material to draw from. And then I just had to do my own research, you know, about it and the topics, and then, you know, begin to sew it all into the field, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love it. And it just came out as an audiobook this year. It never came out. The book came out in 2014 as a print book. But it never came out as an audiobook. And so I got this guy, Adam Blanford, who did the audiobook for House of Honor. I loved his narration. And so I asked him if he would do it for A Minor. It's called A Minor, A Novel of Love, Music, and Memory. And he did. He said he would do it. And then we got the music that's talked about in the story embedded into the audiobook. So when you listen to Adam's narration, the music plays, and it's so special, and it just creates a much bigger experience. Yeah. It's deeper and richer, and, you know, you're hearing the music that is what they're working on in the book. It's amazing. I love it. So Adam really had the technology know-how as to how to get that to happen. And we worked together to pit the music right in the exact spot where it should be in the text and where it should end. And yeah, it was great. So that's kind of a new thing that just happened earlier this year. And yeah, I just love how that came out. It's really fun.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. And as an audiobook lover myself and a narrator myself, I definitely want to pick that up, because that's something that I feel like that is a perfect example of the use of your medium. That's one of the things that that's always been like a hang up for me on a lot of different movie musicals. If they just look like they are just going a little bit beyond what they can do on stage, they're not taking advantage of the medium that they have. But if they can broaden things out so that way something's happening over here and then something's happening over here and then over here, you know, and there's, you know, more effects and much more, you know, richer look to it, and it feels like you're really immersed in the world, that's using the medium. And that sounds exactly like what what this project is, considering what the topic is, what the story is. If you don't incorporate music into it, it feels like you're doing it a disservice.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think that because we're all operating here on multiple sensory levels,
yeah,
I do think that it's better to, if you can, to try and bring your work to a multisensory place. So like,
yeah,
it's photography with poetry, it's music embedded into the story. And then in this book, in House of Honor, the publisher was able to get all of the art that is talked about in the book. It's like part of the book. I mean, the art is actually, the paintings are part of it. So you get the paintings and they help tell the story. And so, mm-hmm, yeah, I always want to try and do that. I want to be able to give people, you know, more than just the words on the page. And it's interesting because I've had authors say to me, well, your words on the page should just be good enough. That should create all the images. That should create all the sounds. And I'm like, that's true. But if I can access more to augment it, I think, mm-hmm, I'd like to. So yeah, people have different takes on that. People definitely have different takes. But I prefer it because, like you said in the beginning, I like to write in different genre. I love to cross over and push the envelope in different ways. And yeah, mm-hmm, I wanna be able to give people more than just the words on the page. Yeah.
And it also kind of reminds me in a strange way of what the Star Wars novels are like when they make their way to audiobook, because when they're put together, the producers of those books, they have the Lucasfilm archives at their fingertips. So you have the John Williams themes, you have all the different sound effects that Ben Burtt designed over the years, you have all of that, and that all gets incorporated into the book. And now you have this amazing, immersive experience, and you have someone like Jonathan Davis who can just paint a picture with the way that he tells the story that someone like Matthew Stover wrote. Because like, I'm, you know, all that stuff, like that's those sort of things, that's using audiobooks in the very, very best way. And that's something that as someone who has different goals and has achieved several of those goals as an audiobook narrator, being involved in an experience like that, that's definitely one of those goals.
Yeah, I agree. That's great. I'm so glad you referenced those Star Wars books, because I think that everyone should be doing that. I mean, yeah, you know, it's like, why wouldn't you? I mean, when House of Honor came out, my younger son, it's funny, the oldest son, who was so good at the piano, he still plays all the time, but he didn't pursue that as a career. Mm-hmm. But our younger son went to college and majored in drum set and stayed in Nashville, and he is pursuing that as a career. He plays with Jack Forrest Blocker, and he's loving it. You know, he's just loving it. But I said to him, hey, I want to create a music track for House of Honor. I want to be able to have the pieces of music I talk about in the book become something on Spotify that people can access. And he just did that for me. He was like, sure, I can just make that for you. And so it's fun to, you know, I can offer that, right, as like a lead magnet as for something, you know, if there's a promotion and the book is on sale for, you know, $4.99 or something, I can offer that to entice people to click. Right. So yeah, you just get more, I get more bang for my buck doing that. And obviously the reader does also, for sure.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And then when it comes to putting together the books like this and working with these different publishers, there is always that universal moment, and that's something that every author loves to experience, and that's something that it can go all the way. They can have done dozens of books, but it always feels like the first time when they are holding that finished book in their hands. So what's it been like for you when you have those experiences?
Oh, that's such a great question. Thank you for asking that. That's a great question. It's definitely different for every book. My first book, the children's book that I did with my mom, the publisher was in Minnesota, and they allowed us to have input into every facet, what paper was chosen, because my mother's paintings were going to be in the book. And it was ended up being Italian Garda silk. The paper actually had silk in it, because it shows the canvas of an oil painting better than other kinds of paper. And so that book was such a treasure, because it was my first book. I did it with her, and we got all this input into cloth choices for the cover, the hardcover version. I mean, it was fantastic. And so that, as an art person, who my mother is the artist of the book, that was truly just so special to hold that book for the two of us and see how beautiful it was. It was just a treasure, honestly. And so then in House of Honor, every book is different, but House of Honor, I didn't really have much input. It was the opposite. It wasn't, I wasn't asked questions like, what do you want the, you know, what are you thinking of for, you know, this? It just all kind of happened. And all of a sudden I was told, oh, the hardcover is coming out. The paperback came out first. And then I was told the hardcover is coming out 2 weeks later. I'm like, I didn't know we were doing a hardcover. Oh, yes. Yeah, of course. Oh, and then the audiobook will come out in the fall. Oh, I didn't know we were doing an audiobook. So it was very little inputs, but I loved it because it was always like surprising of all the good things that were happening. An amazing thing happened with House of Honor that has never happened to me before. And I've done five different books. Yeah. And honestly, when they sent me the cover art, it was done by a woman who they outsourced. It was called Hannah Linder Designs. And I never heard of them. I didn't know anything about them. And they sent me the cover art and they said in the contract, you know, you're going to get four different covers and you're going to have input on all of them. And then we're going to revise, you know, and then you're going to input again. And then you're going to have to choose. You're not going to get to do this forever on the cover. Right. And I was like, I get it. And I'm pretty decisive anyway. So I was like, fine. Well, they sent me this cover, this first cover, this one right here. I love literally everything about it. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the hand of the angel in the nativity painting. It's holding the banner. It's this torn away, like cool paper, this brown paper that like a painting would be wrapped in. And you're like revealing. I love the font. I loved everything. And I wrote to them and I said, I can't believe I'm saying this. I have absolutely no changes. I love everything about it. And I mean, that never happens.
Yeah, I know. That is so cool. That is so cool.
It was. It was so exciting.
That is something that, having gone through indie publishing and then making the move to moving into working with a small press and then a different small press. And now I'm on my third one for my books getting a good relaunch. And the one thing that I have always kind of grasped onto, and this is me living in a world where so many of my friends are all independent authors. And they have taken the reins and they have seen their books through from conception all the way to completion, and more power to them. I think that's wonderful. And they are always saying how the main element to them is control. They want to have 100% control over everything they do. They want to go forth with it. And then they can reap the benefits of what's there. And again, more power to them. And they ask me, Why did I deviate from that? Why did I go from independent publisher to working with a publisher? And I said, along the lines of what it is that you dealt with, I want people that are going to invest in me. I want to know that I have people that have my back, that look at what I have done and said that is worth investing in. And that to me is incredibly validating. And that's something that I can't have if I'm the only voice that is saying, yes, this is good enough. This will move forward.
I agree. I think that all of the, you know, the self-publishing tracks, you know, Ingram Spark and Amazon and all of them, I think it's wonderful because it allows more people to create and to get work out into the world. But you learn as you go, you know, and you become much more savvy in realizing that Hannah Linder Designs, I mean, I am not doing this. I'm not creating this. It's not possible. I couldn't do it. And I get it. And I'm like, okay, this is why this is worth it. This is why, you know, you're getting way more. And this publisher, they did something no one else has done for me. They have a really good grasp on the type of awards they like to enter the books into. And there's different, all kinds of awards for all kinds of different books. And there's so many I could not possibly take the time to research, oh, what award should I put House of Honor in? There's a zillion different ones. Well, they know that. They know where that needs to go and what they need to apply for. And they'll still take my input. And then they'll tell me, no, you know, we don't want to spend, you know, X number of dollars for that one. It's not really a good fit for your book. And so they'll, you know, they're discerning about it, but they bring that kind of how to set your book apart, which I didn't do in my first novel, even though I had a publisher for it. I liked this publisher very much, and they were super creative, and I loved the job they did. But they didn't know anything about that. They didn't enter any other books into awards. They didn't tell me anything about it. I knew nothing about it. So it's very much a learning curve as you go, and the people that you work with and they bring to the projects what they know and what they're good at. And so I think it is worth it to continue, everyone who's doing this, to continue to grow into, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try to get an agent. You know, I'm going to try to get work out through even a small press and see what that experience is like.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so what was, when you mentioned the publishers making their decisions, making very educated decisions on which awards to apply for, once those awards started coming in, what was that feeling like?
I was very surprised. So the first thing that I ever got on this book was the Kirkus Star, the starred review. And when the review came to me in my email, I remember sitting in, you know, in front of my computer, and my husband was working upstairs, and I just started screaming. I was absolutely screaming. I don't really do that.
I would have too.
I was so shocked. Yep. And, you know, I think of that as like, oh, of all their books, you know, what is it? 15%, 10 to 15% get stars. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't believe it. So that was my first time to be like, oh, wow. This book is worthy. This is worthy. Yeah. Like, it's not just me who thinks so. And then as the other ones came in, some of them, the publisher entered the book into, I didn't even know. They didn't even tell me. And then they wrote to me and said, oh, you know, at American Book Fest, you just won first place for historical fiction for the year. And I was like, oh, what's American Book Fest? So those were kind of a learning curve. I had to kind of learn, what is this? And, you know, I didn't win in all of the ones that they entered. I mean, they entered the Christie Awards for Christian fiction, and it didn't get anything out of that, you know? And so it's not like, oh, every single thing, you know, it's slam dunked in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that was fine. I mean, I obviously didn't expect that, but I did have to learn my way through the award thing. And I think the most fun, honestly, was that they entered it into the Next Generation Indie Book Awards. I'd never heard of it. They entered it for suspense. So it's an indie book award, and they entered it, and it did win. And because it won, I got to go to Philadelphia to the American Library Association convention last summer. Wow. And then I got to just like merchandise the heck out of this book with librarians and people there and be on a podcast. And I got to speak about it at the big library in downtown Philadelphia. This is from an award I had never heard of. And, you know, they made that happen, and they paid for it because they were so excited that it won that award. So, you know, you don't really know what you're getting into with a publisher, but they know what they're doing. And you do have to believe that. You have to believe it. You know, it's like, it's okay. You're not going to like everything about what they did. The editing of this book really cleaned this book up quite a bit. I had the main character much racier, you know, much more edgy than he ended up being. But they needed to be comfortable with the product. And so I had to just make that work. So, yeah, it's a give and take. But I learned a lot, you know, from them in the process. So, it's definitely, you know, your journey, the road to creativity. I mean, it's a constant learning curve when you're trying to get work out there and do it in a high quality way. You just have to be willing to make sacrifices. Yeah.
And that road never ends. As long as you yourself want to stay on that road, then you get to stay on that road. You don't have to get out. You don't have to bail out or anything. You can just keep moving forward, and everyone can keep learning. It's not like you can just say that you know everything that there is to learn. If there is, then what's the point of moving forward? But sounds like you're constantly moving forward, even to this day, like after getting those awards, which is having gotten a couple myself finally for my own writing. Good. This year. And that's from two short scripts that I had written. And
cool.
The funny thing is that the festival where I got my first one, it was recommended that I apply to it through a friend of mine, through someone that I'd known since eighth grade who had become an indie filmmaker and suggested this one particular festival. He said that particular one, you know, would be a great fit for you. Give it a shot. You never know. You never know. So I was just like, you know what?
Good.
I'll give it a shot. I'll do it. And then all of a sudden it got an official selection. And then a week late,
great.
2 weeks later or so, it said it's now an award nominee. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to the festival then. And at the end of it, they had their big gala and they announced my script as one of the winners. So it was really was just an incredible feeling. And that was the first time I had ever won any sort of award for my own writing. And so just getting that and then getting one last month for a different script that I had written, incredibly validating. And it's one of those things that just kind of keeps you pushing forward and has you saying like, I can do better. I can build on this. And so with everything that you have right now, what projects are in the works? You said that people were trying to coax you into writing a prequel to House of Honor, but do you have something else that's on the horizon?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I am going to finish this nonfiction book that I'm doing, which I love. I'm going to finish that. Right. I have a children's book that I wrote in spring that I just sent to an agent just the other day. I wrote the proposal last week and I love the story. I love it. And so I'm hoping that children's book is really next in terms of contracted work.
Right.
And then my daughter, so I have this book about classical music, right? It's dedicated to our oldest son. And then this book is fine art, dedicated to our youngest son. And then our daughter spent her whole career as a professional dancer and she just retired.
Oh, wow.
And so I have to do a book about the world of professional dance. And I'm going to set it in France. And I definitely know nice. It's going to be about a couple, a male, female professional dance couple set in France and about something that happens in their relationship as it relates to their art as well as art itself. So yeah, that's the next big fiction project. And also I'm going to write a book about oil. My dad spent his entire career in the oil and gas industry. And I do know a lot about the oil business and how absolutely devious and insane it is. So that series Landman, remember that Landman series that was just recently on? And that's a really, And that, I think it was on Netflix or something that focuses on the Landman, but this is different, but I would love to write that as a tribute to my dad later on in my life. But the next novel is going to be the dance book. So then I'll have classical music, fine art, and dance covered. And so that'll be like a neat little trilogy of arts novels.
I was just about to say, are you going to put together maybe like a box set for them as a trilogy?
Yes, of course. Good
there
job,
you go.
George. Yes.
There you go.
Yes, definitely. Yes, definitely.
Oh, I love that.
I'm excited.
I love that. That is so cool.
Yeah,
that is so cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And if there is someone out there that is looking to break into storytelling the way you have in the sense, like granted, everyone has their own path, but if someone has this burning story that they've researched, they want to really kind of focus on getting that put onto their key, from their keyboard onto their computer monitors into a book form, what is something that they should do? What is something that you suggest that they would do?
Okay. Yeah. I think definitely go to a conference, pick a writing conference. There's a whole bunch of them. So okay, so one of the ones that comes to mind is the Blue Ridge Mountain Writing Conference. Mm-hmm. There's Write to Publish. There's Chicago Writers. There's so many places, but pick one in their geography so you don't have to pay too much money to go to it.
Right.
And, you know, read all about who's going to be there. You got to make sure you're going to one that has agents and mm-hmm. editors at the conference. And then you can, through Submittable, you can submit your work to the conference itself, usually pretty far in advance. And then it gets funneled into the agents and authors. That's what, for big conferences, it usually happens that way. And then someone will reach out to you and say, hey, I want to talk to you more about this project. Let's talk about it. Smaller conferences, you can just bring your work and you get a 10-minute sit down. You can sign up and just sign up for a time slot, sit down for 10 minutes and pitch your work to an agent or an editor, and they'll ask you a few questions. The whole meeting is like 15 minutes, but that person, if they like it, it's worth it. First off, because you hone and shape your pitch, which is so important. And then the agent or editor, if they like it, is going to ask you the questions. So you have to learn how to answer those questions and do a good job of it. And then you might get asked for more material. So they might say to you, hey, you know, I'd like to read this, the first 50 pages of this. Can you email it to me? Or I'd like to read the whole manuscript if it's a children's book. So I think that conferences are just an absolute quick way, no guarantee, but a pretty quick way to get work in front of people and, you know, definitely improve what you're saying about your work and how you're saying it and possibly get even farther. So that'd be one thing. And the other one would be to join a professional writing organization. I'm part of 3 different writing organizations. I love them all. And I utilize all of them and am active in all of them. And I think you have to be, because all of those are designed to have and provide connections for you through agents and editors that other people in the organization are working with. And then they also might provide manuscript editing services, manuscript review. The House of Honor really grew out of a very small manuscript group when I was first writing the book, that I would take the work to the group of 9 women and they would just beat it up and, you know, ask questions and make me think about stuff. And so manuscript review groups. So the organization has to have benefits. It's not just like, oh, I'm in a writing group and we don't do anything. It's got to have benefits to you based on where you want to be going with your work.
Yeah.
But yeah, go to conferences and join a writer's organization. I'm actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm part of 5 different writer's organizations. And I actually do involve and engage with all of them. Yeah.
That's terrific. And as speaking as someone who is not only a part of 2 different writing organizations myself, the Missouri Writers Guild and the St. Louis Writers Guild, and having served as president for the Missouri Writers Guild from 2017 to 2018, one of the things that I was able to do as the vice president from 2016 to 2017 was I got to chair a conference. And it was a smaller conference, but at the same time, we had a decent turnout with the agents that were there. And they were able to do exactly what you were saying. They were able to sit down and go through the discussions with the agents and see about possibly getting somewhere with the manuscripts that they had. But the really fun thing that I got to add on was something that I was really proud of. And that was since it was a 3-day conference, it was Friday evening to all day Saturday to Sunday afternoon. And on Sunday afternoon, we had a couple of additional breakout sessions, but we also had our main people, our faculty members, you know, like the ones that were leading the breakout sessions on Saturday.
Yeah.
And our guest of our different keynote speakers that were there as well, they got to do what we called 10 for 10. And so for $10, you got to spend 10 minutes with that person one-on-one and go over whatever you had and ask any questions that you had and try to basically just get as much information and knowledge and experience from them as possible. And it became a real hit. It wound up being something that I hope that in the future, once the Missouri Writers Guild is able to kind of stretch out and give conferences that are more than one day long again, would have experiences like that. Because I think that was something that I think a lot of people really enjoyed.
That's a great idea. I mean, that 10 for 10, who wouldn't do that? Are you kidding? Yeah. I'm happy to pay $10 to talk to somebody about this, you know, kids book that I have that I just finished. I mean, I'd love that. So yeah, that's a great idea. Really good idea.
And where can my listeners find you on social media?
So my Instagram for my books is my name, Margaret Ann Philbrick. It's funny, there's another Margaret Philbrick in the world, and she is a trumpeter in Chicago. And so I had to put Anne into my book name because otherwise I was getting trumpeting gigs. So Margaret Ann Philbrick is my book Instagram. And then Seasoned Poetess is my poetry Instagram. And then my website, of course, which is just margaretphilbrick.com, has everything on it. Everything is there. And yeah, I think those would probably be the main places. And I'm on Facebook, of course. I mean, you know, everyone is, which is my name as well. So yeah, anybody can reach out to me who has questions, or, you know, I do occasionally do online guidance for people who have a manuscript done and, you know, really want somebody to take a look at it and give them feedback. I do that, you know, maybe like once or twice a year. So yeah, people can reach out to me through my website is the best way to find me. And then those Instagrams too.
Nice. Very nice. And I'm so, as always, I'm always so inspired by the guests that I have here, and Margaret is definitely no exception. And I hope that this conversation has been just as inspiring and motivating for all of you. Margaret has continued to push herself forward and continued to be in competition with herself to continue to improve every single day. And that has led her already to a very successful career in writing, multi-award winning, multi-accolades that are given to her work so far. And she is not done, and she is still moving forward. And I hope that all of you are as well. Just do not let any sort of setback stop you from pushing forward, because you're the only one who can get off of this road to creativity. You're the only one that can park your car and step out. Don't park it. Just keep going. Keep moving with staying on that same road. Stay the course, because the more you keep going, the more you learn, the more you are able to adapt, the more you're able to take what's been given to you and keep moving forward with it and keep on improving with it. And eventually you're going to find yourself in these positions where you are screaming at the top of your lungs because you just got an amazing review from Kirkus. So please keep going. I want nothing but the best for all of you. And in these crazy times, we need your stories, we need your visions and your ideas now more than ever. So for Margaret Ann Philbrick, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to he'sgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@he'sgotit.com.